St. Thomas Aquinas, Part 3. The reason for dwelling here, however, upon the position of the Emperor Frederick, as a type of his time, in his culture and his violence, is his concern for philosophy and his quarrel with religion, is not merely concerned with these things. He may here be the first figure that crosses the stage, because one of his very typical actions precipitated the first action, or obstinate inaction, which began the personal adventures of Thomas Aquinas in this world. The story also illustrates the extraordinary tangle in which a family like that of the Count of Aquino found himself, being at once so close to the church and so much at odds with it. For Frederick II, in the course of these remarkable maneuvers, military and political, which arranged from burning heretics to allying himself with Saracens, made a swoop as of a predatory eagle, and the imperial eagle was rather predatory, upon a very large and wealthy monastery, the Benedictine Abbey of Monte Cassino, and stormed and sacked the place. Some miles from the monastery of Monte Cassino stood a great crag or cliff, standing up like a pillar of the Apennines. It was crowned with a castle that bore the name the Dry Rock, and it was the eyrie in which the eaglets of the Aquino branch of the imperial family were nursed to fly. Here lived Count Landulf of Aquino, who was the father of Thomas Aquinas and some seven other sons. In military affairs he doubtless rode with his family, in the feudal manner, but apparently had something to do with the destruction of the monastery. But it was typical of the tangle of the time that Count Landulf seems afterwards to have thought that it would be a tactful and delicate act to put his son Thomas as abbot of the monastery. It would be of the nature of a graceful apology to the church, and also, it would appear, a solution of a family difficulty. For it had long been apparent to Count Landulf that nothing could be done with his seventh son Thomas, except to make him an abbot, or something of that kind. Born in 1226, he had from childhood a mysterious objection to becoming a predatory eagle, or even to taking an ordinary interest in falconry, or tilting, or any other gentlemanly pursuits. He was large and heavy and a quiet boy, and phenomenally silent, scarcely opening his mouth except to say suddenly to a schoolmaster in an explosive manner, "What is God?" The answer is not recorded, but it is probable that the asker went on worrying out answers for himself. The only place for a person of this kind was the church, and presumably the cloister. And so far as that went, there was no particular difficulty. It was easy enough for a man in Count Landulf's position to arrange with some monastery for his son to be received there, and in this particular case he thought it would be a good idea if he were received in some official capacity that would be worthy of his worldly rank. So everything was smoothly arranged for Thomas Aquinas becoming a monk, which would seem to be what he himself wanted, and sooner or later becoming abbot of Monte Cassino. And then the curious thing happened. Insofar as we may follow rather dim and disputed events It would seem that the young Thomas Aquinas walked into his father's castle one day and calmly announced that he had become one of the begging friars of the new order founded by Dominic the Spaniard. Much as the eldest son of the squire might go home and airily inform the family that he had married a gypsy, or the heir of a Tory duke state that he was walking tomorrow with the hunger marchers organized by alleged communists. By this, as has been noted already, we may pretty well measure the abyss between the old monasticism and the new, and the earthquake of the Dominican and Franciscan Revolution. Thomas had appeared to wish to be a monk, and the gates were silently opened to him, and the long avenues of the abbey, the very carpet, so to speak, laid for him up to the throne of the mitred abbot. He said he wished to be a friar, and his family flew at him like wild beasts. His brothers pursued him along the public roads, half rent his friar's frock from his back, and finally locked him up in a tower like a lunatic. It is not very easy to trace the course of this furious family quarrel, and it eventually spent itself against the tenacity of the young friar. According to some stories, his mother's disapproval was short-lived, and she went over to his side. But it was not only his relatives that were embroiled. We might say that the central governing class of Europe, which partly consisted of his family, were in a turmoil over the deplorable youth. Even the Pope was asked for tactful intervention, and it was at one time proposed that Thomas should be allowed to wear the Dominican habit while acting as abbot in the Benedictine Abbey. To many this would seem a tactful compromise, but it did not commend itself to the narrow medieval mind of Thomas Aquinas. He indicated sharply that he wished to be a Dominican in the Dominican order, not at a fancy dress ball, and the diplomatic proposal appears to have been dropped. Thomas of Aquino wanted to be a friar. It was a staggering fact to his contemporaries, and it is rather an intriguing fact even to us. For his desire, limited literally and strictly to this statement, was the one practical thing to which his will was clamped with adamantine obstinacy till his death. He would not be an abbot. He would not be a monk. He would not even be a prior or ruler in his own fraternity. He would not be a prominent or important friar. He would be a friar. It is as if Napoleon had insisted on remaining a private soldier all his life. Something in his heavy, quiet, cultivated, rather academic gentleman would not be satisfied till he was, by fixed authoritative proclamation and official pronouncement, established and appointed to be a beggar. It is all the more interesting because, while he did more than his duty 1,000 times over, he was not at all like a beggar, nor at all likely to be a good beggar. He had nothing of the native vagabond about him, as had his great precursors. He was not born with something of the wandering minstrel, like St. Francis, or something of the tramping missionary, like St. Dominic. But he insisted upon putting himself under military orders, to do these things at the will of another, if required. He may be compared with some of the more magnanimous aristocrats who have enrolled themselves in revolutionary armies, or some of the best of the poets and scholars who volunteered as private soldiers in the Great War. Something in the courage and consistency of Dominic and Francis had challenged his deep sense of justice, and while remaining a very reasonable person, and even a diplomatic one, he never let anything shake the iron immobility of this one decision of his youth, nor was he to be turned from his tall and towering ambition to take the lowest place. The first effect of his decision, as we have seen, was much more stimulating and even startling. The general of the Dominicans, under whom Thomas had enrolled himself, was probably well aware of the diplomatic attempts to dislodge him and the worldly difficulties of resisting them. His expedient was to take his young follower out of Italy altogether, bidding him proceed with a few other friars to Paris. There was something prophetic even about this first progress of the traveling teacher of the nations, for Paris was indeed destined to be in some sense the goal of his spiritual journey, since it was there that he was to deliver both his great defense of the friars and his great defiance to the antagonists of Aristotle. But this, his first journey to Paris, was destined to be broken off very short indeed. The friars had reached a turn of the road by a wayside fountain, a little way north of Rome, when they were overtaken by a wild cavalcade of captors, who seized on Thomas like brigands, and who were, in fact, only rather needlessly agitated brothers. He had a large number of brothers. Perhaps only two were here involved. Indeed, he was the seventh. Friends of birth control may lament that this philosopher was needlessly added to the noble line of ruffians who kidnapped him. It was an odd affair altogether. There is something quaint and picturesque in the idea of kidnapping a begging friar, who might, in a sense, be called a runaway abbot. There is a comic and tragic tangle in the motives and purposes of such a trio of strange kinsmen. There is a sort of Christian cross-purposes in the contrast between the feverish illusion of the importance of things, always marking men who are called practical, and the much more practical pertinacity of the man who is called theoretical. Thus, at least, did these three strange brethren stagger or trail along their tragic road, tied together, as it were, like criminal and constable, only that the criminals were making the arrest. So their figures are seen for an instant against the horizon of history, brothers as sinister as any since Cain and Abel. For this queer outrage in the great family of Aquino does really stand out symbolically as representing something that will forever make the Middle Ages a mystery and a bewilderment. Capable of sharply contrasted interpretations like darkness and light, for in two of these men were there raged, we might say screamed, a savage pride of blood and blazonry of arms. Although they were princes in the most refined world of their time, which would seem more suitable to a tribe dancing round a totem, for the moment they had forgotten everything except the name of a family. That is narrower than a tribe, and far narrower than a nation. And the third figure of that trio, born of the same mother and perhaps visibly one with the others in the face or form, had a conception of brotherhood broader than most modern democracy, for it was not national, but international. a faith of in mercy and modesty far deeper than any mere mildness of manners in the modern world, and a drastic oath of poverty, which would now be counted quite a mad exaggeration of the revolt against plutocracy and pride. Out of the same Italian castle came two savages and one sage, or one saint more pacific than most modern sages. That is the double aspect confusing 100 controversies. That is what makes the riddle of the medieval age, that it was not one age, but two ages. We look into the moods of some men, and it might be the Stone Age. We look into the minds of other men, and they might be living in the Golden Age, in the most modern sort of utopia. They were always good men and bad men, but in this time good men who were subtle lived with bad men who were simple. They lived in the same family, they were brought up in the same nursery, and they came out to struggle, as the brothers of Aquino struggled by the wayside, when they dragged the new friar along the road and shut him up in the castle on the hill. When his relations tried to despoil him of his friar's frock, he seems to have laid about them in the fighting manner of his fathers, and it would seem successfully, since this attempt was abandoned. He accepted the prism in itself with his customary composure, and probably did not mind very much whether he was left to philosophize in a dungeon or in a cell. Indeed, there is something in the way the whole tale is told, which suggests that through a great part of that strange abduction, he had been carried about like a lumbering stone statue. The only one tale told of his captivity showed him merely in anger, and that shows him angrier than he was before or after. It struck the imagination of his own time for more important reasons, but it has an interest that is psychological as well as moral. For once in this life, for the first time and the last, Thomas of Aquino was really hors de lui, riding a storm outside the tower of intellect and contemplation in which he commonly lived. And that was when his brothers introduced into his room by some specially gorgeous and painted courtesan, with the idea of surprising him by a sudden temptation, or at least involving him in a scandal. His anger was justified, even by less strict moral standards than his own, for the meanness was even worse than the foulness of the expedient. Even on the lowest grounds, he knew his brothers knew, and they knew that he knew, that it was an insult to him as a gentleman to suppose that he would break his pledge upon so base a provocation, and he had behind him a far more terrible sensibility, all that huge ambition of humility which was to him the voice of God out of heaven. In this one flash alone, we see that huge, unwieldy figure in an attitude of activity, or even animation, as he was very animated indeed. He sprang from his seat and snatched a brand out of the fire and stood brandishing it like a flaming sword. The woman not unnaturally shrieked and fled, which was all that he wanted. But it is quaint to think of what she must have thought of that madman of monstrous stature, juggling with flames and apparently threatening to burn down the house. All he did, however, was to stride after her to the door and bang and bar it behind her, and then, with a sort of impulse of violent ritual, he rammed the burning brand into the door, blackening and blistering it, with one big black sign of the cross. Then he returned and dropped it again into the fire, and sat down on that seat of sedentary scholarship, that chair of philosophy, that secret throne of contemplation, from which he never rose again. Chapter 3. The Aristotelian Revolution. Albert the Swabian, rightly called the Great, was the founder of modern science. He did more than any other man to prepare that process, which has turned the alchemist into the chemist and the astrologer into the astronomer. It is odd that, having been in his time, in this sense almost the first astronomer, he now lingers in legend almost as the last astrologer. Serious historians are abandoning the absurd notion that the medieval church persecuted all scientists as wizards. It is very nearly the opposite of the truth. The world sometimes persecuting them as wizards, and sometimes ran after them as wizards. The sort of pursuing that is the reverse of persecuting. The church alone regarded them really and solely as scientists. Many an inquiring cleric was charged with the mere magic of making his lenses and mirrors. He was charged by his rude and rustic neighbors, and would probably have been charged in exactly the same way if they had been pagan neighbors or Puritan neighbors or Seventh-day Adventist neighbors. But even then he stood a better chance, when judged by the papacy, than if he had merely been lynched by the laity. The Catholic pontiff did not denounce Albertus Magnus as a magician. It was the half-heathen tribes of the north who admired him as a magician. It is the half-heathen tribes of the industrial towns today, the readers of cheap dream books and quack pamphlets and newspaper prophets, who still admire him as an astrologer. It is admitted that the range of his recorded knowledge of strictly material and mechanical facts was amazing in a man of his time. It is true that, in most other cases, there was a certain limitation to the data of medieval science, but this certainly had nothing to do with medieval religion. For the data of Aristotle and the great Greek civilization were in many ways more limited still. But it is not really so much a question of access to the facts as the attitude of the facts. Most of the schoolmen, if informed by the only informants they had that a unicorn was one horn or a salamander lives in the fire, still used it more of an illustration of logic than an incident of life. What was really said was, if a unicorn has one horn, two unicorns have as many horns as one cow. And that has not one inch the less a fact, because the unicorn is a fable. But with Albertus in medieval times, as with Aristotle in ancient times, there did begin something like the idea of emphasizing the question, but does the unicorn only have one horn, or the salamander a fire instead of a fireside? Doubtless, when the social and geographical limits of medieval life began to allow them to search the fire for salamanders, or the desert for unicorns, They had to modify many of their scientific ideas, a fact which will expose them to the very proper scorn of a generation of scientists which had just discovered that Newton is nonsense, and that space is limited, and that there is no such thing as an atom. This great German, known in his most famous period as a professor in Paris, was previously for some time professor at Cologne. In that beautiful Roman city, there gathered round him in thousands the lovers of that extraordinary life, the student of the Middle Ages. They came together in great groups called nations. And the fact illustrates very well the difference between medieval nationalism and modern nationalism. For although there might be any morning be a brawl between the Spanish students and the Scottish students, or between the Flemish and the French, and swords flash or stones fly on the most purely patriotic principles, the fact remains that they had all come to the same school to learn the same philosophy. And though that might not prevent the starting of a quarrel, it might have a great deal to do with the ending of it. Before these motley groups of men from the ends of the earth, the father of science unrolled his scroll of strange wisdom, of sun and comet, of fish and bird. He was an Aristotelian, developing, as it were, the one experimental hint of Aristotle. And in this he was entirely original. He cared less to be original about the deeper matters of men and morals, about which he was content to hand on a decent and Christianized Aristotelism. He was even in a sense ready to compromise upon the mere metaphysical issue of the nominalists and the realists. He would have never maintained alone the great war that was coming for a balanced and humanized Christianity. But when it came, he was entirely on its side. He was called the Universal Doctor because of the range of his scientific studies. Yet he was in truth a specialist. The popular legend is never quite wrong. If a man of science is a magician, he was a magician. And the man of science has always been much more of a magician than the priest, since he would control the elements rather than submit to the spirit, who is more elementary than the elements. Among the students thronging into the lecture rooms, there was one student, conspicuous by his tall and bulky frame, completely failing or refusing to be conspicuous for anything else. He was so dumb in the debates that his fellows began to assume an American significance in the word dumbness. For in that land it is a synonym for dullness. It is clear that, before long, even his imposing stature began to have only the ignominious immensity of the big boy left behind in the lowest form. He was called the dumb ox. He was the object, not merely of mockery, but of pity. One good-natured student pitied him so much as to try to help him with his lessons, going over the elements of logic like an alphabet in a horn book. The dunce thanked him with pathetic politeness, and the philanthropist went on swimmingly, till he came to a passage about which he was himself a little doubtful, about which, in point of fact, he was wrong. Whereupon the dunce, with every appearance of embarrassment and disturbance, pointed out a possible solution which happened to be right. The benevolent student was left staring, as at a monster, at this mysterious lump of ignorance and intelligence, and strange whispers began to run around the schools. A regular religious biographer of Thomas Aquinas, who, needless to say, was the dunce in question, has said that by the end of the interview, his love of truth overcame his humility, which, properly understood, is precisely true. But it does not, in the secondary psychological and social sense, describe all the welter of elements that went on within that massive head. All the relatively few anecdotes about Aquinas have a peculiar vividness if we visualize the type of man, and this is an excellent example. Amid those elements was something of the difficulty which the generalizing intellect has in adapting itself suddenly to a tiny detail of daily life. There was something of the shyness of really well-bred people about showing off. There was something even, perhaps, of that queer paralysis and temptation to prefer even misunderstandings to long explanations, which led Sir James Barré, in his amusing sketch, to allow himself to be saddled with a brother Henry he never possessed, rather than exert himself to put in a word of warning. These other elements, doubtless, worked with the very extraordinary humility of this very extraordinary man, but another element worked in his equally unquestionable love of truth in bringing the misunderstanding to an end. It is an element that must never be left out of the makeup of St. Thomas. However dreamy or distracted or immersed in theories he might be, he had any amount of common sense, and by the time it came not only to being taught, but to being taught wrong, there was something in him that said sharply, "Oh, this has got to stop." It seems probable that Albertus Magnus himself, the lecturer and learned teacher of all these youths, who first suspected something of the kind. He gave Thomas small jobs to do, of annotation or exposition. He persuaded him to banish his bashfulness so as to take part in at least one debate. He was a very shrewd old man and had studied the habits of other animals before the salamander and the unicorn. He had studied many specimens of the most monstrous of all monstrosities, that is called man. He knew the signs and marks of that sort of man, who is, in an innocent way, something of a monster among men. He was too good a schoolmaster not to know that the dunce is not always a dunce. He learned with amusement that this dunce had been nicknamed the dumb ox by his schoolfellows. All this is natural enough, but it does not take away the savor of something rather strange and symbolic about the extraordinary emphasis with which he spoke at last. For Aquinas was still generally known only as one obscure and obstinately unresponsive pupil among many more brilliant and promising pupils. When the great Albert broke the silence of his famous cry and prophecy, "You call him a dumb ox? I tell you this dumb ox shall bellow so loud that his bellowings will fill the world." To Albertus Magnus, as to Aristotle or Augustine, or any number of other and old teachers, St. Thomas was always ready, with the hearty sort of humility, to give thanks for all his thinking. Nonetheless, his own thinking was in advance on Albertus and other Aristotelians, just as it was in advance on Augustine and the Augustinians. Albert had drawn attention to the direct study of natural facts, if only through fables like the unicorn and the salamander, but the monster called man awaited much more subtle and flexible vivisection. The two men, however, became close friends, and their friendship counts for a great deal in this central fight of the Middle Ages. For, as we shall see, the rehabilitation of Aristotle was a revolution almost as revolutionary as the exaltation of Dominic and Francis, and St. Thomas was destined to play a striking part in both. It will be realized that the Aquino family had ultimately abandoned its avenging pursuit of its ugly duckling, who, as a black friar, should perhaps be called its black sheep. Of that escape, some picturesque stories are told. The black sheep generally profits at last by quarrels among the white sheep of a family. They begin by quarreling with him, but they end by quarreling with each other. There is rather confusing account concerning which members of his family came over to his side while he was still imprisoned in the tower. But it is a fact that he was very fond of his sisters, and therefore probably not a fable that it was they who engineered his escape. According to the story, they rigged up a rope to the top of the tower, attached to a big basket, which must have been a rather big basket if he was indeed lowered in the fashion from his prison, and escaped into the world. Anyhow, he did escape by energy, external and internal, but it was only an individual energy. The world was still pursuing and persecuting the friars, quite as much as when they fled up along the road to Rome. Thomas Aquinas had the good fortune to gather under the shadow of the one great outstanding friar, whose respectability it was difficult to dispute, the learned and orthodox Albertus. But even he and his were soon troubled by the growing storm that threatened the new popular movements in the church. Albertus was summoned to Paris to receive the degree of a doctor, but everyone knew that every move in that game had the character of a challenge. He made only the request, which probably looked like an eccentric request, that he should take his dumb ox with him. They set out like ordinary friars or religious but vagabonds. They slept in such monasteries as they could find, and finally in the monastery of St. James in Paris, where Thomas met another friar who was also another friend. Perhaps under the shadow of the storm that menaced all friars, Bonaventure, the Franciscan, grew into so great a friendship with Thomas the Dominican that their contemporaries compared them to David and Jonathan. The point is of some interest, because it would be quite easy to represent the Franciscan and Dominican as flatly contradicting each other. The Franciscan may be represented as the father of all mystics, and the mystics can be represented as men who maintain that the final fruition or joy of the soul is rather a sensation rather than a thought. The motto of the mystics has always been, taste and see. Now St. Thomas also began by saying, taste and see, but he said it of the first rudimentary impressions of the human animal. It might well be maintained that the Franciscan puts taste last, and the Dominican puts it first. It might be said that the Thomist begins with something solid, like the taste of an apple, and afterwards deduces a divine life for the intellect, while the mystic exhausts the intellect first, and, finally, in that good sense of God, is something like the taste of an apple. A common enemy might claim that St. Thomas begins with the taste of fruit, and St. Bonaventure ends with the taste of fruit. But they are both right. If I may say so, it is a privilege of people who contradict each other in their cosmos to be both right. The mystic right is right in saying that the relation of God and man is essentially a love story, the pattern and type of all love stories. The Dominican rationalist is equally right in saying that the intellect is at home in the topmost heavens, and that the appetite for truth may outlast and even devour all the duller appetites of man. At the moment Aquinas and Bonaventure were encouraged in the possibility that they were both right, by the almost universal agreement that they were both wrong, it was, in any case, a time of wild disturbance, and, as is common in such times, those who were trying to put things right were most vigorously accused of putting things wrong. Nobody knew who would win in that welter, Islam, or the Manichees of the Midi, or the two-faced and mocking emperor, or the Crusades, or the old orders of Christendom. But some men had a very vivid feeling that everything was breaking up, and that all the recent experiments and excesses were part of the same social dissolution, that there were two things that such men regarded as signs of ruin. One was the awful apparition of Aristotle out of the East, a sort of Greek god supported by Arabian worshippers, and the other was the new freedom of the friars. It was the opening of the monastery and the scattering of the monks to wander over the world. The general feeling that they wandered like sparks from a furnace hitherto contained, the furnace of the abnormal love of God, the sense that they would utterly unbalance the common people with counsels of perfection, that they would drift into being demagogues. All this finally burst out in a famous book called The Parallels of Latter Times by a furious reactionary, William de Saint-Amour. It challenged the French king and the pope, so that they established an inquiry. And Aquinas and Bonaventure, the two incongruous friends, with their respectively topsy-turvy universes, went up to Rome together to defend the freedom of the friars. Thomas Aquinas defended the great vow of his youth for freedom and the poor, and it was probably the topmost moment of his generally triumphant career, for he turned back the whole backward movement of his time. Irresponsible authorities have said that, but for him, the whole great popular movement of the friars have been destroyed. With his popular victory, the shy and awkward student finally becomes a historical character and a public man. After that, he was identified with the mendicant orders. But while St. Thomas may be said to have made his name in the defense of the mendicant orders against the reactionaries, who took the same view of them as his own family had taken, there is generally a difference between the man making his name and a man really doing his work. The work of Thomas Aquinas was yet to come. But less shrewd observers than he could already see that it was coming. Broadly speaking, the danger was the danger of the Orthodox, or those who too easily identify the old order with the Orthodox, forcing a final and conclusive condemnation of Aristotle. There had already been rash and random condemnations to that effect, issuing here and there, and the pressure of the narrower Augustinians upon the Pope and the principal judges became daily more pressing. The peril had appeared, not unnaturally, because of the historical and geographical accident of the Moslem proximity to the culture of Byzantium. The Arabs got hold of the Greek manuscripts before the Latins, who were the true heirs of the Greeks, and Moslems, though not very orthodox Moslems, were turning Aristotle into a pantheistic philosophy still less acceptable to orthodox Christians. The second controversy, however, requires more explanation than the first. As is remarked on an introductory page, most people do know that St. Francis at least was a liberator of large sympathies, that, whatever their positive view of medievalism, the friars were in a relative sense a popular movement, pointing to greater fraternity and freedom, and a very little further information would inform them that this was every bit as true of the Dominican as of the Franciscan friars. Nobody now is particularly likely to start up in defense of feudal abbots or fixed and stationary monks. Against such impudent innovators as St. Francis and St. Thomas, we may, therefore, be allowed to summarize briefly that the great debate about the friars, though it shook all Christendom in its day. But the greater debate about Aristotle presents a greater difficulty, because there were modern misconceptions about it that can only be approached with a little more elaboration. Perhaps this is really no such thing as a revolution recorded in history. What happened was always a counter-revolution. Men were always rebelling against the last rebels, and even repenting of the last rebellion. This could be seen in the most casual contemporary fashions, if the fashionable mind had not fallen into the habit of seeing the very latest rebel as rebelling against all ages at once. The modern girl with the lipstick and the cocktail is as much a rebel against the women's rights woman of the 80s, with her stiff stick-up collars and strict teetotalism, as the latter was a rebel against the early Victorian lady of the languid waltz tunes and the album full of quotations from Byron, or as the last, again, was a rebel against a Puritan mother to whom the waltz was a wild orgy and Byron the Bolshevist of his age. Trace even the Puritan mother back through history, and she represents a rebellion against the cavalier laxity of the English Church, which was at first a rebel against the Catholic civilization, which had been a rebel against the pagan civilization. Nobody but a lunatic could pretend that these things were a progress, for they obviously go first one way and then the other. But whichever is right, one thing is certainly wrong, and that is the modern habit of looking at them only from the modern end. For that is only to see the end of the tale. They rebel against they know not what, because it arose they know not when. Intent only on its ending, they are ignorant of its beginning, and therefore of its very being. The difference between the smaller cases and the larger is that in the latter there is really so huge a human upheaval that men start from it like men in a new world. And that very novelty enables them to go on very long, and generally to go on too long. It is because these things start with a vigorous revolt that the intellectual impetus lasts long enough to make them seem like survival. An excellent example of this real story of the revival and the neglect of Aristotle. By the end of the medieval time, Aristotelism did eventually grow stale. Only a very fresh and successful novelty ever gets quite so stale as that.